Good evening. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On tonight's show, we hear a discussion of the decriminalization of sex work. The Drug Policy Alliance held its 2017 International Drug Policy Reform Conference recently in Atlanta, Georgia. This year's policy conference was for once not dominated by white middle-class male libertarians, thankfully, and instead emphasized harm reduction, identity politics, and advocacy for people who use drugs. One of the panels I attended was titled Sex Work, the Drug War, and the Need for Decriminalization. Tonight on Prison Pipeline, we bring you audio from that panel. First, let's hear from Sarah Mann. She's a former sex worker and injection drug user who holds a master's degree in literary studies, and she's the editor of Open Minds Quarterly, a literary magazine about mental health published by the Northern Initiative for Social Action in Northern Ontario, Canada.
So in Canada, we have what are ostensibly more progressive laws around drug use and sex work than in the United States. So I just wanted to talk about some of the ways that regulation is playing out on the ground in Canada. So our criminal code applies to the whole country. Our health policy is regulated at the provincial level, and then there are all sorts of zoning and licensing regulations at the municipal level. Our sex work law has very recently changed. There was a court challenge by sex workers to declare existing laws unconstitutional. The Supreme Court did decide that these laws were unnecessarily putting sex workers in danger. The government's response to that case was that they have no responsibility to protect sex workers. It's a dangerous job. If we get ourselves raped or murdered, that's really just what we've chosen to do. They lost, which was great, but then they wrote new laws, what's sometimes called the Swedish model or the Nordic model, demand-side criminalization. What's happening with that, and it might make more sense to understand that the driving force behind the war on sex workers and the war on drugs in Canada is colonialism. So it's not just draconian or Puritan sort of laws, it's also laws that have been in place for hundreds of years, specifically to marginalize Indigenous populations and poor populations. So anytime sex workers' or drug users' lives are taken up in those laws, even under ostensibly progressive regulations, what happens is the lives of poor people and the lives of Indigenous people are regulated by criminal law, and they're regulated by a police force and a government that has explicitly said that it doesn't give a how many of us get raped, how many get murdered, how many Indigenous women disappear. So it's not in our interest to have these people sort of playing with our lives in the first place. Since demand-side criminalization came in, it's been more difficult to arrest outdoor sex workers under solicitation laws. Solicitation had, originally it was any communication in public, you could be arrested, and now it has to cause a problem under some other law. So what the cops are doing is arresting women for stopping traffic. Once they've arrested them for stopping traffic, then they search them, they find drugs, and they charge them under our drug laws. So the two work together to make sure that the same poor and Indigenous and racialized women that are very visible as sex workers and visible as unwanted in the communities can continue to be criminalized, even as the government can say, oh, but we have these much gentler, saving women from trafficking laws now. The proposed change to our marijuana laws to legalize marijuana works very much in the same way. So right now it's still criminal to possess or sell marijuana in Canada. Health Canada does send it to folks. It comes in like a pink can in the mail if you have medical marijuana. And that's cool. Like, it's better than nothing, absolutely. but the proposed change would specifically criminalize distributing marijuana to minors. So right now, where the mandatory minimums range from 1 year to 5 years for distributing marijuana, under our more progressive legalized regime, the mandatory minimum for selling marijuana to a youth would be 14 years. And in Canada, that's a long time. That's essentially a life sentence. That's as strict as we get. And the people it's going to affect are other youth. So it'll be the poor or racialized or otherwise visible youth. I remember when I was in high school, I was buying from other kids who will be criminalized under this law, under legalization. So the move for decriminalization is really just to take that regulation of our lives, all aspects of our lives, out of the hands of a government that just doesn't have our interests at heart.
That was Sarah Mann, editor of Open Minds Quarterly. Now let's hear from Sasanka Janadasa. They're a consultant and partner at Reframe Health and Justice in Washington, D.C.
And everything that y'all just said was so on point, and I co-sign all of it. I think that what I'd like to add is just to a sort of translation away from the legalese of it to how I think about it is there's no reason under decriminalization that police should just be hanging out at sex worker strolls. That's essentially what we want. We're there's no reason for you to be hanging out here. And under legalization, there's a lot of reasons for police to be hanging out to make sure that they're meeting sort of certain regulation markers. So in order to meet fewer regulation needs, what we're looking for with decriminalization is that why are the cops hanging out there in the first place? And that way we're hoping to sort of lessen some of those more negative external things where people are getting arrested for jaywalking, where people are getting arrested for standing outside people's houses, for public nuisance, for being broke or poor or not having a place to live. So in D.C., where I'm based, D.C. is working on a decriminalization bill as well that was introduced last week. Oh my God, last week. And I think what was really important about that is we're not saying, it's not the primary thing that sex workers get arrested for is selling sex. That's not true in D.C., at least. What we are noticing is that people are calling the cops for sex work related reasons, then cops come and they arrest people for whatever reason, for charges that won't stick, interrupt their ability to make money for the weekend by throwing them in jail for the weekend because they're able to do that because there's no one to get them out until Monday and DC doesn't have bail. So the way that it works is, which is actually great, and we can talk about that more later, but then there's no one to get you out of jail until Monday. So they'll put you in jail on Friday night. You can't get out until Monday morning. And it doesn't matter if a charge doesn't stick, if you've already been arrested and your ability to make money for the weekend is completely interrupted. So those are some of the things that sex workers are dealing with in a way that I think often some of the ways that people who are working on drug policy often... There are some folks who are working on drug policy who are focusing very specifically on nonviolent drug possession, whereas sex workers and people selling sex are often targeted in the ways that drug sellers are targeted. And I think that's sort of the ways that the war on drugs and the war on trafficking intersect that is sort of different than thinking about possession. If you're thinking about possession, you might think about sex work paraphernalia, if you want to put it that way, things like condoms, things like even like business cards from social service providers that would indicate that you might be a sex worker. Those are things that might get you targeted or regulated. So we're really careful, HIPS, I used to work at HIPS, which is where Cindy's the ED, about not trying to put too much information about sex work or drug use on our cards, because if somebody gets picked up and they have that card, that could be enough to arrest them on a sex work charge. Even if it wouldn't stick, it doesn't matter, because all the police are trying to do is make sure that the residents who are calling to complain, they can pick somebody up and put them in jail for the weekend. And we want an opportunity to say, well, sex work is decriminalized, so you can't call us, and the police can't just come for sex work reasons. So that's sort of how I think about decrim.
That was Sasanka Janadasa. They're a consultant and partner at Reframe Health and Justice in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Tonight, we're looking at the decriminalization of sex work. The audio on today's program was recorded at the Drug Policy Alliance 2017 International Reform Conference, which I attended recently in Atlanta, Georgia. Now let's hear from Dr. Alex Lutnick, a senior research scientist at RTI International in San Francisco, who's a former sex worker and the author of Domestic Minor Sex Trafficking: Beyond Victims and Villains, which was published in 2016 by Columbia University Press.
Couple things to add since we've now introduced the war on trafficking into the mix. What happened with the passage of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act in 2000 is that there were two definitions of trafficking introduced. The first one basically equates any type of sex work with trafficking. And then there's the definition of a severe form of trafficking, which is what most people would think of, which involves force, fraud, or coercion. Or if the person is under 18 and selling sex, then they're considered a victim regardless. But what's happened is with this reframe, right? So if we think back about the historical legacy of sex worker rights movements, great momentum towards decriminalization up until when HIV hit and all of a sudden it went to, wait, we have to educate about how we're not vectors of disease, like we're not transmitting. And then sort of got a handle on that, took a good 10, 15 years, and then ventured back into these conversations about decrim right around the time that this trafficking discourse showed up. And so then it becomes anytime a decriminalization measure is introduced, well, this is going to allow for trafficking. It's going to invite pimps and panderers and traffickers into our communities. It's going to lead to the exploitation of our children, which has not happened. But in the guise of anti-trafficking efforts, we see the same problematic approaches that have been done on the war on drugs. So we see increased sentencing. We see the criminalization of health-promoting materials. So in the 2008 reauthorization of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, condoms can be used as evidence of a RICO offense, a racketeering offense. Why? Because they're manufactured oftentimes outside of the state in which they're being used. So police throughout the U.S. are being trained. Anytime you see a condom involved in a prostitution act, this could make it a federal case. Confiscated. This person can be charged as a trafficker. If a social service provider, right, harm reduction group, peer-based group are handing out condoms, it puts them at risk for being charged as traffickers. We also see the enhancement of drug charges. So in that same reauthorization in 2008, just providing somebody with an illegal substance could get you charged as a trafficker because it's considered a form of coercion. So it could be, as Sarah was saying, you know, it's peers, right? We help each other out. We maybe say, hey, this is a good client, connect with him, connect with her, or hey, I have access to some stuff, you can have it, and then all of a sudden you're looking at these trafficking charges. And so because it's so heavily law enforcement focused, there's increased incentive for police officers to arrest folks. There's increased incentives to prosecute people, whether that's the dynamic that's happening or not. And so I was looking, because I'm a data nerd and I do research, and so it's good to have numbers to root ourselves, was looking at arrest rates in California, where I'm from. And so the most up-to-date I could get, complete data, was 2014. And among adults charged with prostitution, nearly three-fourths are people of color. Nearly all of them are women, right? And so and we see this in the training videos that police have in California, which all the scenarios presented are young women or minors being exploited by a third party who's always a person of color. And so the racial profiling, the dehumanization that we've seen enacted in the war on drugs, which is really the war on drug users, is playing out in the same exact way through the guise of the war on trafficking. And at the end of the day, the people who get hurt by that are adults and young people who are selling sex because of choice or circumstances. It is very rare in these undercover operations that anyone who is being exploited is identified. And I'm doing an evaluation right now of 4 years of prostitution-related arrests in San Francisco. I don't know how they gave me the data, but they did. So I have 4 years of incident reports with the written narratives. And in not a single undercover operation, so this could be responding to ads that people have placed online, it could be posting decoy ads, it could be going into massage establishments, and not a single one of those have they identified somebody who's being exploited, although that's the money that they're getting from the federal government is for anti-trafficking efforts. And so it's a real misuse of funds that end up getting people caught in the criminal justice system or further caught which then nearly eliminates any possibility to exit out of the sex industry if that's what they're wanting to do. So I'll pause there because I can ramble for a while about this.
That was Alex Lutnick, PhD, a senior research scientist at RTI International. Let's hear now from Cindy Clay. Ms. Clay is the executive director of HIPS, a harm reduction, advocacy, and outreach organization based in Washington, D.C., and she's an internationally recognized expert with over 20 years of experience in program development, nonprofit management, and evaluation for improving the health and safety of people who use drugs, sex workers, and transgender individuals.
So, yeah, I think sex workers have been kind of in this, we've been this interesting kind of partner with the drug user movement, right? For many years. I know when HIPS showed up on the scene probably in maybe the early 2000s, you know, we were kind of like this sex worker organization that did harm reduction, but harm reduction was only talking about drug use and was very much about heroin and not other drugs, and tried to kind of help, you know, like figure out where we fit in. And some of the questions that we have gotten over the years, and I'm super excited that there's this many people here. I'm super excited about the conversation we're having. I think our first sex worker panel at DPA did not go this well necessarily. We had a bunch of people ask if we were going to get naked before our panel, and so I'm glad that we're here and having this conversation. We didn't get naked.
no, I know, but like, what year was this?
What year is that? That was L.A. What year was L.A.? 2011?
Wow.
That was only 6 years ago. Okay, so why should people who do drug policy advocacy care about sex worker advocacy? And my answer to that question is twofold. One is I would hope, and I tend to be a little Pollyanna in my view on people, because I think people are just generally misinformed, even though they want to do good things. and I have to think that way, or else I'll just never get out of bed. But so I would hope that if you're interested in drug policy and you're interested in decriminalizing or legalizing drugs, you do that both because maybe you just want easier access to drugs, which is fine. But also because you see the harms that criminalization has and the harms that criminalization is having on people, right? And you care about people. And this, like, the war on drugs is about drugs, but really it's about incarcerating. Like really it's not about drugs. Like, they could make it a war on tacos, right? And, like, anybody, like, they just...
I think they did try.
They actually did try to make a war on tacos.
Right?
So, like, they'll find any reason they can to arrest primarily people of color and poor people, and drugs are the excuse, right? And so, in many ways, so is sex work. Sex work is the excuse of why we are arresting or putting or locking people up for the weekend, because we just don't want to see people like that on our streets. And so what has been happening since the war on drugs got a little unpopular, or people have been critiquing it more loudly, which is great, is that they're taking those laws, specifically prostitution-free zones. Those came directly from drug-free zones, right? And luckily in D.C., D.C. was one of the first place to introduce prostitution-free zones. It was used as a national model, even though it, like, accomplished absolutely nothing other than just providing an excuse for harassing people out of a neighborhood. And then 2 years ago, they wanted to make them permanent in D.C. And basically a prostitution-free zone is not somewhere where prostitution is free. Unfortunately, depends on which side you're on. Just like drug-free zones are not places where drugs are free, they could state a certain block area was a prostitution-free zone, and the burden of evidence was lowered to suspicion. So there, if an officer had a suspicion that you were engaging in prostitution, then you could be told to move on from the area. And if you did not move on from the area, then you could be arrested. And so again, like this displacement of people who make us uncomfortable, of people that we don't want to see on the streets, is criminalization against sex work is used to push people out of areas and to arrest away problems. And so like, again, that's an example, and there are many others about how drug war policies are being used in now, like the new war against sex workers. A lot of the language, especially with the anti-trafficking movement, has taken a lot of clues from the drug war. It is highly funded. It allows police officers to buy cool tools and new toys that they can use to catch and to, you know, investigate traffickers. And so like a lot of the lessons learned from we need our drug policy friends to be on the lookout for laws and policies that are being enacted in your own communities. Because like it's the same people who are being affected by the drug war and by the new kind of anti-trafficking war on sex work.
That was Cindy Clay, Executive Director of HIPS in Washington, D.C. Now finally, let's hear from Andrea Ritchie. Ms. Ritchie is a member of the Movement for Black Lives Policy Table and is a researcher in residence on race, gender sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women.
Thanks. I think I'm just agreeing wholeheartedly with everything everyone's saying. I think what I can add is that one thing I didn't say in my bio is that I'm on the policy table of the Movement for Black Lives, and the vision for Black Lives that was released in August 2015 calls for decriminalization of drugs and prostitution in the same demand. And it's a demand for reparations at the same time for the harms caused by both the war on drugs and the war on prostitution. And the reasoning behind that, I mean, the demand around the war on drugs was sort of like, duh, people were like, of course, that's one of the prime pathways to prison for black folks in the era of mass incarceration and source of violent policing. The one, decriminalization of prostitution, was not instinctive, right? And so it took some of us being like, but it's the same people who are being targeted, but also, particularly for black women, it's the same stereotypes that are historically rooted, right? And the same kinds of police violence that we're talking about that people are experiencing, whether it's extortion of sex so that you don't face a long mandatory minimum drug charge, or extortion of sex so that you don't face the prostitution charge and the consequences people were talking about. It's sexual violence in the way that Holst's Law perpetrated. There are so many Holst's Laws across the country, and they're targeting the same groups of people. And that for black women, drugs are definitely a primary pathway to prison, but so are prostitution-related offenses, and then also these public order offenses that we're talking about. So I think kind of the next layer that we're bringing into it is what we've been talking about here, is that decriminalization of prostitution doesn't decriminalize blackness or black bodies or our presence in black spaces. And so that it has to be decrim and it has to be like a really broad understanding of decrim and targeting things like broken windows policing, period, right? Which as a theory names people engaged or believed to be or profiled as engaged in prostitution as a sign of disorder. So you don't need the prostitution law, you just use all the other ones that we were just talking about, right? And the common nightwalker laws have been struck down as unconstitutional, but who cares, right? The cops just do it anyway because it's about targeting a particular group of people. It doesn't matter which law, we just pull them out, you know, whichever one. Trespassing, same thing happened in Philly. They decriminalized street-based prostitution in downtown Philly, so they arrested people for obstructing traffic. I mean, that's just a common story. So the framework there has to be decrim and just decrim blackness, right? Decrim presence in public spaces, decriminalize poverty, decriminalize homelessness, decriminalize all the ways in which people are targeted in public spaces. I think the only other thing I would add is the just to reinforce the point you were saying about police being primary perpetrators of violence, that's something that the research of the Young Women's Empowerment Project, which is participatory research conducted by young women and girls and trans folk in the sex trade, who were at the 2011 panel saying these same things, is that, you know, when they did research of the primary sources of violence in the lives of young women in the sex trade, there's a pie chart that I wish I could show you. Like, the biggest sources of violence are police and healthcare providers. Like, they kind of were neck and neck for the top. And the tiniest slice was the people that we send police and healthcare providers in to supposedly protect people against, which is individuals, clients, and pimps. It doesn't mean that they're not that violence doesn't exist and it's not egregious, but just the pie chart is striking when it's like this much police, this much healthcare providers, and this much the people that we're sending them in to deal with, right? So I feel like there's also been a report that was put out by the Urban Justice Center that interviewed trafficking survivors that reinforced the point that raids don't identify trafficking survivors, and when trafficking survivors are asked about raids, usually from the prison cell that they're sitting in, they're like, anything but the police would have been the way to get me out of this. If you had actually stopped criminalizing everyone around me, they could have helped me. If you had not made it, and now instead we make it a crime for cab drivers to drive people to do sex work, and people who were trafficked were like, no, the cab driver was the one who helped me. What are you doing? Like, it's just literally we're not listening. And I think the same thing happens in the context of the drug war. We don't actually talk to people who are using drugs, and we don't talk to people who are selling drugs, and we don't talk to folks about what it is they need, which is why the Movement for Black Lives really put that in the reparations framework, which is like, we need to talk about what it is we need, and it's definitely not police. So I think that would be all I had to add to the conversation.
That was Andrea Ritchie. She's a researcher in residence on race, gender sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women. And that's it for this week. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline. You can find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the KBOO website at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. I want to thank all the people you just heard, including Andrea Ritchie, Alex Lutnick, Cindy Clay, Sasanka Janadasa, and Sarah Mann. I want to thank the Drug Policy Alliance for including this panel discussion in its 2017 Reform Conference. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Vitaklis. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.